But how do we treat those that mistreat us? How do we respond to others that maybe at times make it difficult for us to deal with them? In some ways, we began this section last week in the section we studied in Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 through 42. And Jesus, in a sense, continues that same idea. How do we respond to others? Jesus has talked to us about having our righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. He's talked to us about how in our actions, in our thoughts, in our attitudes, we are to have those things under control. Now specifically in our dealings with others, we are to be careful. Last time we talked about, in a sense, a passive type of love. And by that I mean we were specifically interested in how do we respond to others. How do we respond to what they do to us? I think there's a sense in which we might consider the love that we talk about this morning even a more active love. How do we respond to others just day by day, regardless of how they treat us? You see, this love isn't necessarily in a response to something they've done. It's just how we are going to treat them regardless of the activities that are going on all around us. And so not just don't retaliate against someone that may be mistreating you, but going further than that and actually loving our enemies. Let's begin reading in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good unto them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, sendeth the rain on the just and the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. I'm going to ask a series of questions that is going to form our points this morning as we look at this passage of Scripture that Jesus is continuing to teach in the Sermon on the Mount, and begin by asking what? What is it that Jesus is talking about? He's talking about love. Maybe even more specifically, he's talking about the misconception of love that was being taught at this time. I believe we've seen a number of examples throughout this last chapter in which Jesus is showing us a contrast in what was being commonly taught at that time by the religious teachers, and contrasting that with what the law actually taught or expected, and certainly with what he expected of his disciples. And so they had a misconception concerning love. They said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. While indeed we can go back to the law and find that it taught the love of a neighbor, can we go back and find that it taught us to love our enemies? First think of Leviticus chapter 19. In verse 17 and 18, it is said, thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. Thou shalt not in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge, nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people. But thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. The law indeed taught, love your neighbor. Even as Jesus comes along, and he also is going to teach us to love our neighbor. But did it teach us to hate our enemy? No. In fact, that's probably a misrepresentation, a confusion possibly, that had been being taught but was not actually part of the law of Moses. few suggestions as to why that possibly was. Some have suggested, even such as McGarvey, has said, well, it was because of the wars that they were to fight with their enemies. You think about Israel, and here you are told as a nation, you're going to go into the land of Canaan, and I'm going to give it to you. But presently, there are nations dwelling there, sinful and corrupt nations. You go in and you drive them out of that land, and you inhabit it for yourself. And so, yes, you were to drive out the inhabitants of the land. You were not to make peace with them. And so the idea was, it's hard to love your enemy while you're fighting him. But it has to be remembered. They were acting as servants of God in those wars. They were carrying out God's plan, His design. This was even a judgment against those wicked nations whose sins were said to be full, who even it is said the land was spewing them forth because of their sins against God. It wasn't personal vengeance, but obedience to God's will, carrying out His plan. Others have suggested this may have been taught because it was viewed that the law didn't address anyone but the Jew. Had the idea, yes, I must love my neighbor, but it doesn't tell me anything about anyone else. Therefore, it's argued the only one I have to love is the Jew. He who is my brother, my people, whether religiously, whether racially. But it goes and ignores the concern that the law placed even upon those who would be considered your enemy. In fact, the law did say something about enemies. In Deuteronomy 22, verse 1 through 4, the law had taught about restoring the possessions of your brother if it had become lost. But the law also talked about restoring the possessions of one who was an enemy. Consider Exodus chapter 23, verse 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldest forbear to help them, thou shalt surely help him. Even here, one that would be considered your enemy, he says, are you not to help him? You're not to help the possession here, his donkey, his oxen. Maybe it's lost, maybe it's struggling under a burden, and you're going to help him and do good even unto your enemy. So indeed, it hadn't taught them to hate their enemy. It's written in Proverbs chapter 25 and verse 21. If your enemy be hungry, give him bread to eat. If he be thirsty, give him water to drink. Taught them concern, love, even one for another. Others think possibly this was because of the imprecatory psalms. These were psalms that spoke of invoking evil maybe against one that was an enemy. A popular example is found in Psalm 139. What I'm going to notice in a minute, we'll read that, but these didn't advocate a personal vengeance upon one that would be considered an enemy. But they showed the psalmist as a representative of God, as one of His people. And here, these are God's enemies. They're wicked, not because they've set themselves as my enemy, but because they have set themselves as an enemy of God. He hates the wicked. He hates the wicked ways. He counts them as their enemies. Because here the psalmist is striving to follow God, and his enemy has set himself against serving God and doing that which is right. Consider Psalm 139, and I'll begin reading in verse 19. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hateth Thee? Am not I grieved with those that rise up against Thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This isn't a personal hatred or a vengeance that the psalmist is taking out on someone that's done him wrong. He's crying out to God and say, there are wicked people that surround me, God, that have set themselves against you, against your holy name, against all that is right and against all that is good. Therefore, I hate them. Therefore, there is even an idea here of invoking some evil upon them. But it's because they aren't doing that which is right in the sight of God. Therefore, they have set themselves against that which is right and good. I believe he even presents there the idea that he could hate the wicked with a perfect hatred, a perfect anger. Again, not personal. This is the type of anger that I can love the person, I can love the individual, and yet hate their actions. I can hate the sin that is taking over in their life. I can pray, as it were today, maybe the mouths of wicked and false teachers might be stopped in any way that's possible, and yet at the same time have an interest in their souls that they would know and turn and do right. If they be converted, so be it. But my prayer is that they would stop spreading error and lies over the face of the world and introducing religious confusion. In the same way, I today hate those that do wickedly. And I would pray for them to be stopped even by the hand of God. And yet ultimately that prayer and that concern is that they would do those things that are right and those things that are good. And so a hatred for the enemies of God, not our own. When we come to Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is speaking much more of a personal enemy, of someone that is personally doing us wrong, not in the general sense that the psalmist was, of someone turning against God. And so there was a confusion here, even in their love, as they said, love your neighbor but hate your enemy. And yet Jesus says, love even your enemy. And so how? If you consider the what, Jesus is talking about love, but how? How do I love? See, this love here, he says, is not just those that we identify as neighbors. Not just those that I have some personal attachment to, but even those that would be identified as enemies. And Jesus is even going to give us an example of how we are to do this. Does Jesus not teach us, in fact, that we never exactly know who all our neighbor might be? Does He not tell us that our neighbor might be anyone that we have absolutely even maybe no connection with? They're not family, they're not friends, maybe they're not of my same religious beliefs, they're not of the same race, there's maybe great distance that would separate us, they're not someone that just lives next door, but my neighbor might be anyone that is in need. And so as He teaches us love your enemy and your neighbor, is He not teaching us to love all men? I think specifically of the parable of the Good Samaritan. Here, those that were closest to the man that had been beaten and robbed and left on the side of the road dead. The priest and the Levite passed by him. They had the closest connection to him. And yet it was the Samaritan. A Samaritan that saw not a Jew, but a man that was in need of help. There's no great racial connection between them here. No true family relation that was recognized at that time. And yet he had compassion on him. He saw him as a neighbor. He saw him as one to do good unto. And Jesus is going to ask the question, now which of these three, thinkest thou, was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. And Jesus said, go thou and do likewise. Luke chapter 10. Verse 36 and 37. This is hard for many. Now, I can understand loving my neighbor. I can understand loving someone that I have an emotional attachment to. I can understand loving someone that is going to love me in return. But you begin talking about loving someone that I have no connection to. And maybe even harder than that, you begin talking about someone that would count themselves as an enemy of mine, that would set themselves against me, and you say to love them, that is a hard commandment for us to get our hands around, to wrap our minds around. That doesn't necessarily just come easily to us. In fact, it can oftentimes be quite difficult. I think part of the misunderstanding there, or part of the difficulty that we have, is exactly what Jesus tells us to do. You see, Jesus says, love your enemy. I'm going to make a distinction there that He said, love your enemy, not like them. The Greek had a number of different words for for love. Here, Jesus uses the word agape. This is a love that seeks the best interest of another. This is a love that can be expressed at someone even though I have maybe no particular emotional connection to, even though I don't particularly like them. This is a type of love that can actually be legislated. You see, someone can tell me, maybe a boss, an employer, can tell me, you're going to do this particular job and you're going to like it. You can't tell me that. I may do the job, I may act like I like it, but you can't make me like it. You can't legislate in that way an affectionate type of love. But you can legislate agape love. You can say you are going to seek the best interest of somebody else, even though you don't have that same particular emotional attachment. This is a type of love that has to be cultivated and has to be worked at. You see, liking someone is something that oftentimes comes maybe rather naturally. Someone I have a particular attraction to. Someone I share a particular interest with. Someone that I'm comfortable with. I might say I like them, that I love them in that sense. But someone that's my enemy, it's hard to like them. It's hard to really consider myself some great friend of them. But I can love them. I can love them in that I'm going to do what's best for them and that I'm going to try to help them in my response unto them. What are some examples of that type of love? We've already mentioned one, the Good Samaritan of Luke chapter 10. Here Jesus uses that example, a man passing by. I don't know the man. He would consider me an enemy, and likely I would consider him an enemy. Our people don't have anything to do one with another. And yet he's in need. He's hurting. He needs help. And I have the opportunity to do it. My response of love is that I'm going to help him. I don't have to become his greatest friend. I don't have to have a particular emotional attachment to him, but I have to love him. I have to help him. And so he did so. I think about Jesus, maybe as an example. As Jesus is hanging on the cross, and even those are standing before him that are mistreating him, that are putting him to death, that are railing against him. People even that he is dying for, and they don't recognize it. And yet he prays for their forgiveness. Luke 23, verse 34, and Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I guess there's a greater sense there in which Jesus has an emotional attachment. This is the very creation of God, one who He has come to love and to save, and yet even those that would count them as the enemy of Christ, He's going to stand there as they kill Him. Say, Father, forgive them. He wants that which is best for them. I think of David. In 1 Samuel chapter 24 and again in 26 are at least two examples in which David, who is slated to be the next king of Israel, one who at one time was counted as a friend of Saul, now his life is being sought by Saul, king of Israel, for no wrong that he has done. David has at least two opportunities in which he could have taken the life of Saul, sped up the whole process, and yet he had a great respect unto the king of Israel. He's going to allow God to accomplish His purposes and His plans in His own time. He loves Saul, even the one who is seeking his life, and is going to do that which is best for Saul. 1 Samuel 24 and verse 17, Saul will say to David, "Thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded thee evil." At least on occasion, Saul would recognize, I have no reason to hunt you down to seek your life. And at every occasion, you've done unto me good, and I've done wickedly unto you. And yet, did David not continue seeking what was best for Saul? He wanted to do that which was right. Love your enemies. Do that which is right unto them. Might also make a note here that as we think about agape love, that can be legislated, that can be commanded, it also is a love that's active. It's a love that is to be shown, to be expressed. It's more than simply just words. How's it going to be shown in our lives? We're told in 1 John 5 and verse 3, this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments. This is the agape love of God. It's active. We're going to follow Him. We are going to do His will. We're going to keep His commandments. Likewise, our love for an enemy is active. It is shown. It seeks to do good, not respond in evil. It's more than just sentiment. It's more than just words that are spoken. But by our very actions, our attitudes, our deeds unto them, we're going to do that which is right. And so what examples does Jesus give? He says, bless them that curse you. Speak well of them. Praise them even when they speak wrongly of you. Repay evil with good. Reply to bitter words with kindness. Think of 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9. Not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that you should inherit a blessing. Doesn't matter what they say unto me. Doesn't matter how they treat me. I'm going to keep doing that which is right unto them. I'm going to treat them well, even when they would wish me ill. And so I'll bless them even when they curse me. I'm going to do good, he says, to them that hate me. We looked last week at Romans chapter 12, especially the end of that chapter. Think about verse 17 through verse 21. As Paul is there going to write, recompense no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If your enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Yes, they're going to treat you evilly. They're going to hate you, but you do good to them. As much as lieth within you, as much as it is possible, you be at peace with all men. But there's a recognition here. That's not always going to be possible. Some people are going to set themselves against you. They are going to hate you, and yet you do good unto them. Be not the one that's going to initiate evil deeds. Be not the one that's going to reply with wickedness or evil deeds. Instead, you be the one that initiates those deeds, those actions that are good. You speak those words of kindness to those that would wish you ill. We can picture it as removing the stone from their path instead of placing it there. What's going to help them? What's going to be best for them? In my response, in my attitude back to them, is this going to help them? Is this going to hurt them? Is this going to provide an example of that I as a Christian should provide? Or is it going to go counter to that? Jesus had already said in Matthew 5 and verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." Are they going to see the character and the attitude of a Christian? Or by our character and attitude, are they going to be turned away from the cause of Christ? You see, you may want to respond with evil, but more is demanded of us as Christians. We're not to be as the world. We're not to follow that same example. You're special. You're different as a people of God. And so in that third point there, Jesus says, pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. Here is one again that seeks your harm, that would mistreat you, that would abuse you in some way. And yet Jesus says, pray for them. Earnestly petition God on their behalf. Not to destroy them, but to help them. To encourage them to do that which is good. Someone said one time, it's almost impossible to hate someone while you're praying for them, and harder still for your love not to grow while you continue praying for them. We understand the final destination of one that sets themselves against God, that refuses to follow in His will. And so I pity the person. I do. And so I want to pray for them. I want to pray for that which is best. I know the will of God is that all would be saved and to come unto a knowledge of the truth. That in His long suffering, He does not will that any should perish. And I also then ought to have that same type of love and concern that it desires the salvation of all. That I would even pray for the good of one that is going to mistreat me. That's the force of the imprecatory psalm. Here I may pray for the mouths of the false teachers or the workers of iniquity to be stopped, and yet I pray for their good, that they might turn to the truth. We see this maybe in Stephen as well as the example of Jesus that we've already looked at. And here Stephen has tried to teach even those that are about to abuse him that which is right and good. And as they stone him to death, Stephen will pray for the forgiveness of those that are presently taking his life. So the great thing about considering this verse is you recognize Jesus there wasn't just speaking empty words. He was going to live that very example. There were going to be those that mistreated Him. Yet He would try to teach them. Strive to do that which is right. At times would rebuke, yes, to silence and to correct. But He still sought their best interest. He was still willing to die for those that wrongly abused Him. Because it was for their good. But why? Why do we do this? Why would I have that type of love towards an enemy? First, I'm going to suggest unto you, it's not for an earthly reward. He has said here in, verse 46, verse 47, that we don't love them that would love us only. And we don't just salute our brethren only, and not those who maybe are more distant or even those who would mistreat us. I think this is also shown in Luke chapter 6 in a similar account. Luke chapter 6 and verse 35, Jesus said, "But love ye your enemies, and do good and lend, hoping for nothing again, and your reward shall be great. And ye shall be the children of the Highest, for He is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil." What's Jesus telling us? I'm going to show this kind of love even to him that won't show it back. I'm going to be nice even when I don't see a return or a benefit from it. I'm still going to show that kind of love. You see, it's love that's a motivating factor, not some earthly reward that I'm going to gain from it. And so I love my enemy. He also presents for us here the idea, number two, that it's to be less like the world. Here in Matthew chapter 5, he speaks of it as the publicans, verse 46 and verse 47. They know how to act that way. They do it. In Luke's account, in verse 34, he's going to talk about the sinner. Are you only just like the publican and the sinner? Even they know reciprocal love. I'll love you if you love me. I'll give unto you if you give back unto me. Yet Jesus taught something far greater. He said, even in maybe Matthew chapter 7 in verse 12, all things whatsoever that ye would men should do unto you, do ye even so to them. We're to do good to all. Not just family, not just friends, but even your enemies. Reciprocal love is ultimately selfish. But loving your enemies puts away our self-interest and puts theirs first. Instead, he says, as you're less like the world, you're going to be more like your Father. More like God. We studied this year in Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 1. Paul wrote, "Be ye therefore, brethren, followers or imitators of God as dear children." You follow the example of God, not the example of the world. And what's the example of God? He gives His blessings on the just and the unjust, on the evil and on the good. The sun rises, the rain falls on both. There are physical blessings available unto all the people upon the face of this world. Also, God has provided a way of salvation unto all people. He sent the gospel out into all of the world, not just a particular people. He did this even for those that don't love Him. And so be less like the world and more like your Father. That's why you have this type of love. And then finally, to what extent? To what extent am I going to love my enemy? Really already been answered. But Jesus will drive it home once again in verse 48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Perfect even as God is perfect. He's our example. He's the one we're imitating. Perfect oftentimes is used in a sense of completeness, not of sinless perfection. Paul would say in Philippians 3 and verse 12, not as though I had already attained, either were already perfect. He's speaking, I believe, there of a sinless perfection. He says, I haven't reached some plateau in which I can say, I've gone as far as I can. I can't get any more perfecter, if you will. I can't do any better. He says, I keep striving forward. And yet in that same context, in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 15, he says, let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded. As many as are complete, as are whole in Christ Jesus. And I believe that's the way in which he uses it here. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Not sinless perfection, but the example he's just spoken of. God loves the just and the unjust, the evil and the good. And so who is your love to be extended to? Just and the unjust? Your friend and your enemy? Unto all the people of the world. Here God had a love that loved even those that were set against Him, even those that could be counted as enemies. Paul wrote in Romans 5 and verse 10, for if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of His Son, much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. When we were enemies of God, He sent forth His Son into the world. His Son died for us. He did that not for His friends. He did that even for His enemies. God sets there the perfect example. He set the standard. He had a standard of an encompassing love that loved all people. I believe that's the example Jesus is pointing to as recorded in Matthew 5. Be ye therefore perfect, an encompassing love, not just to your friends, but even to your enemies. So Jesus has answered this question of love. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, thou shalt love your enemy. Thou shalt do good unto them even when they seek to do you harm. That's not always going to be easy. In fact, it's oftentimes quite hard. It takes a mindset, a determination. Sometimes takes us pausing and considering for a moment before we react, before we speak. How are my words, how are my actions going to be reflected? Is it the example of God or the example of the world? Jesus says, love your enemies. Seek that which is best for them. And in so doing, you live as your Father instead of the world. You live to a higher standard even than the religious leaders of Jesus' day. You live as a follower of God. Those are things we all have to work at. We all have to struggle with from time to time. Maybe they become easier. Maybe the thought process has become quicker. But yet we still have to think about it. We still have to determine that's going to be my response. A response of love. Whether someone mistreats me, whether someone counts me as an enemy, whether someone would wish me harm, nevertheless, I'm going to continue to love them and seek that which is best. Ultimately, of course, our goal is that they see the example of Christ in us. That they would want to know more about God, the God that we serve and honor. More about the hope that we have in Jesus Christ and be turned unto Him. Is that the type of love that we show in our lives, even unto others, even unto those that would count us as an enemy? Maybe there's someone here this morning that in hearing the gospel of Christ and believing it is ready to put it into action in their lives, ready to repent of their sins, to confess Christ as the Son of God, ready to be immersed, baptized in water for the remission of their sins, that they are washed away. That person is added unto the New Testament church, the body of Christ, Acts 20, Acts 2 and verse 47. Maybe there's someone that recognizes by their example they've fallen short of what they should be, needs to change. Maybe it's a personal decision in our lives that we're going to change how we act, react, how we think, what we say, what we do. Maybe in some ways, by our actions, we brought shame and reproach upon the church that needs to be corrected in a public fashion. Whatever that need might be, wouldn't you make it right as together we stand and sing?